Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 122.NU0603, certificate number 19544, Bill W.
Hi, everybody. My name's Tara, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I want to thank the group for inviting me to speak. And
So we've talked about a lot of different religious movements, some that we might qualify as cults.
We like weird sects and sects. Cults and homegrown charismatic prophets of all kinds.
Right. And we've referred, I think, tangentially to the various practices that you and I have, personal practices, personal religious practices. And
you're a black Muslim.
Yep, that's right.
A lot of people don't know that.
That's right. Elijah Muhammad is my one true prophet.
You're always eating granola or, no way, what's the thing they sell? Some kind of
muesli.
Hand pie.
Yeah.
Strawberry tarts. I have no idea what it is.
But you're a member of a religion, one of the major religions.
Not one of the major ones.
Well, you're
AAA level religion.
But it is a religion. It's recognized as a religion by the religious board.
It's got the stamp of approval. Ka-chunk. Do you go to church on Sunday? Well, here you go. I consider myself a Christian, which is, yes, really one of the bigger religions.
That is a larger religion.
Not as big as Islam or lazy youthful secularism.
Wait, are you saying that Christianity is not as big as Islam?
Is that not true?
Some may argue that Christianity is the religion practiced by the largest number of people in the world.
Yes!
That's right.
Finally, something goes our way. How close is it to... I thought Islam was going to be like a billion people or more.
Some estimates say that there are over 2 billion practicing Christians in the world, and there are 1.3 billion Muslims.
But I feel like your average Muslim is like at least twice as devout as your average on the books Christian.
Well, that's...
So if you're measuring in... What is a unit of religious devotion?
I think...
Prayers
per day? The Muslims are always going to win in prayers per day. But no, you live in a secular city, Seattle, so it doesn't seem like Christians are busy, puttering about here in Seattle doing much self-flagellating or wearing of hair shirts or whatever it is that Christians do.
You don't see that.
But there are Christians all around the world who are much, much busier. Like in Nigeria, for instance, there are an awful lot of Christians. Busy, busy, busy.
Brazil.
With Christianity. Brazil.
By the way, we're going to get letters. It's bean pies is the
bean pies.
Nation
That's
of
right.
Islam.
I knew that.
It's like strawberry tarts, but not delicious.
Well, beans, no, they're sugary. Bean pies, they have sugar in them.
Right, but would you rather have a strawberry tart or a bean pie?
I'd rather have a strawberry
tart. Gun to your head, what do you want?
I'm not actually a black Muslim. So.
Right, but what I'm saying is there's an opening here for some other religious group just to choose a kind of food that's more delicious than a bean pie.
Well, it's interesting.
Like the Girl Scouts have.
It's interesting that you say it this way because, as you know, different Christian sects do appeal to congregants or appeal to people by offering them variations on the theme, right? It's a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
You're selling a lifestyle.
A lifestyle, right.
Is that right?
Like, well, it seems like you're selling, if you take Christianity and you break it down into its component parts.
Which are?
With
carbohydrates, starches.
That's right. Carbon, hydrogen. The story of any major religion is, I think, maybe by design or maybe by the nature of the inscrutability of God, religious stories are somewhat complicated and have a lot of different hot takes. So there is, in my experience at least, no religion where there aren't innumerable sects that spin off as a result of different plausible interpretations of the original experience of either the founder of the religion, the prophets that were receiving the messages either from God directly or through his emissaries or through meditation or whatever.
At first, it all seems like it's the hot takes are all doctrinal. Like in the first century, everybody's mad about, you know, what age you should baptize somebody or, you know, if modalism is good or bad. You know, you get all these heresies. Right. And today, nobody really cares, it seems like. You're just going to pick the pastor who has the nice voice or which mega church has the best guitar sound. Like you're just going by amp.
Yeah, those basically. The initial doctrinal disputes are really small. And then as the church expands and gets translated into many different languages, then you get the real doctrinal disputes, like is transubstantiation real or...
But I'm just saying that all gets very quickly replaced by tribalism.
Not quickly. I mean, it takes a while. It takes a while.
There were thousands of Christian heresies to enjoy, but there was just less going on then.
It's true. And back to your initial comment, I think from the United States, it's difficult for us to appreciate how many Muslims in the Muslim world are actually not really very devout.
I feel like we discussed this when we talked about the Qibla. They're pumping up their numbers just as much as we are.
Well, there are an awful lot of Muslims that are just as casual practitioners of their religion as your sort of average go to church on Sunday American that doesn't really follow maybe all of the teachings of Christ religiously.
Is this the woke take on Islam?
Well,
they're just, you know what? They're just like us. They're lazy. They don't, sometimes they feel like eating pork.
It's from my own personal experience. Like I've traveled in Muslim countries and have experienced the majority of people in those places are just trying to get on down the road. And they have just as sanguine a take on their own religion as most people in America do. And there are evangelists and devout practitioners, but an awful lot of it's just as common in the streets of Marrakesh to meet a young person who rolls his eyes at his overly devout grandmother as you'd be likely to see in a bar in Portland. So 1.3 billion practitioners of Islam, and then coming up in third place.
I don't even know what's in third.
1 billion non-religious.
That's what I said.
People,
lazy millennials. Yeah. My religion is lazy millennials.
Secular, agnostic, atheist, and then 900.
But they're better than everyone else because they're not. They're being good.
That's right.
For its own reward. They're not afraid of hell. Like
no, they're not.
Like us losers.
No, they're living in a hell of their own design now. 900 million Hindus, which suggests that there are a couple hundred million people in India that are going their own way, that are over there in the non-religious category.
Man, and they used to be in third. You know who's mad about secular? To see secularists in third is the Hindus.
Well,
they've got the most to lose.
Although, if you take like all the Buddhists and all the people in China who would be Buddhist if it hadn't been,
that's going to be hard to adjudicate,
right? It's tough. But you've got 400 million people practicing Chinese traditional religion, which is a sort of herbal paganism.
Unlike my religion, it is an herb.
It's a country
lemongrass.
Religion.
It's lemongrass, I think.
And then 375 million Buddhists. And then there are 300 million people practicing some form of indigenous or primal religion. According to this statistic,
seems a little racist to lump them together, but I don't want to cancel you.
And then there are like traditional African religions in the hundreds of millions of people practicing, but not like, you know, not up to let's say more than 100, less than 300.
Would you like to walk back your assertion that Mormonism is a major world religion at this point? Well, at 15 million or so?
Whatever. Is it only 15 million?
Something like that.
That's basically the same number of Jews in the world, 15 million.
Oh, we're neck and neck.
Yeah, that's right. Mormons and Jews, like in the final stretch. Only one can survive.
we're gonna need to reproduce some more.
But of the, let's see, of the 2 billion Christians in the world, let's see how the denominations break out.
I think Catholics is over a billion. And I know that because Jonathan Price says it to Anthony Hopkins in The Two Popes, which I just saw.
But that was a while back, right? Oh, yes, you are absolutely right.
It's like 1.2 or something.
50% of Christians identify as Catholic.
But that's because each Christian is one half Catholic on one side of their body.
Whoa.
They only have to do half the sign of the cross.
Is this another part of transubstantiation that I don't fully understand?
Half of my body turns into Catholic when I eat the wafer.
You have, let's see here, within the Reformation Christians, let's see. Catholics are 1.3 billion people.
Exactly as Jonathan Price says to Anthony Hopkins in the Netflix film, The Two Popes.
It's so crazy that they would get that right. There are 18 million in all of the Eastern Catholic churches.
Greek Orthodox, which are Russian Orthodox.
An awful lot of them. The Byzantine
Coptic
ones.
Coptic Orthodox, Ethiopian Orthodox.
Georgian, Macedonians. And then you have 18 million independent Catholics.
Wait, what does that even...
That's like there's like...
they use birth control?
No, it's like they're apostolic churches, the old Catholic church.
Oh, I see. Non-Roman Catholics.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there are 900 million Protestants, which is an awful lot of Protestants.
And six of them go to church.
And yet they still feel like they're everywhere. So 100 million Baptists. And that includes like Baptists in Tanzania and Brazil.
Well, why wouldn't it?
Myanmar.
Are you implying it should not?
Well, it feels like all Baptists are in Texas. There are
no those are Southern Baptists. I think if there's as long as there's Baptists in Tanzania, you cannot say that Georgian Baptists are Southern Baptists.
Right.
They're like Northern Baptists.
Sure, compared to the Baptists of Tanzania.
Tanzania is way down there.
There are 90 million Lutherans. Which surprises me that Lutheranism would be.
I mean, Minneapolis is a very large city. It's bustling.
It's true.
But those skyways are full of Lutherans.
Hanover also probably has a lot of Lutherans, and so on and so on. An awful lot. There are 60 to 80 million Methodists. My mother was raised a Methodist.
Does she no longer consider herself a Methodist?
She loves the hymns.
Hmm.
But I think that she believes in too much reincarnation and other. My mother has adopted the modern sort of polyglot religion.
Add the thing you just heard about that you like.
Yeah, or just sure. Like I've read a lot of books, and she believes in UFOs. She believes in.
You can be a Methodist and believe in aliens. I assume
can
so.
Can you though? Really?
Do you think the different synods have announced different? Different findings,
different takes,
different doctrinal. So you mentioned the hymns. I was at a Methodist church on Christmas Eve, and the hymn book is ginormous. There were like 600, right. 700 hymns.
They're famous for their hymns.
So many. I mean, how could you learn 600 to 700? You've been in a band. Could you play from a list of 600 to 700 songs?
No, but there are musicians who can. I mean, Robin Hitchcock, all you have to do is name a song and he can play it.
Really? Because that guy's got like 28 albums or something.
He'll make up the lyrics, but if you're like, hey,
it's,
you know.
It's Dial a Song with Robin Hitchcock.
Did you know that Presbyterianism is just the American way of describing the Calvinist church? So Calvinism is alive and well in the world. It's just called Presbyterianism.
Did you know that Presbyterians is an anagram of Britney Spears?
What?
It's very important.
And you're telling me that UFOs aren't part of the Christian liturgy.
Also, best in prayer and priest nearby.
Interesting.
I guess that would be Presbyterian singular. You need the extra S to make Britney. Otherwise, it's just Britney Spear.
Is this something you knew already?
No, I just can't do that on the fly. Can you imagine some Scrabble guy doing that on the fly? This would be the podcast now. You say a sentence and he just anagrams it into gibberish.
There are 20 million Seventh-day Adventists.
Or 140 million One-Day Adventists. Is this, so is the whole show just you saying numbers now? Like, what are we even doing?
I'm loving this, though. What we're doing is we're talking about religion. We're talking about Christianity. I fall in the category of a non-practicing person, right? I do not have
No, you're going to hell.
That's right. I don't have a religion. I've been a student of comparative religions as part of my comparative history of ideas education.
But that just means you don't have a church or a congregation. It doesn't mean you're not interested in spirituality or faith.
Right. And I think my whole life, like a lot of questioning people or curious people, I've been unsatisfied with any particular answer, including the particular answer of agnosticism or atheism or even the generalism of a generalized spirituality. All of those things have nothing has sated my curiosity, but also my curiosity has never dimmed.
It's a problem that all these organizations provide answers, and churches see that as the best thing they can do. Like, this is why you need us. In tough times, we have the answers. But really, I mean, I wonder if that's what one way in which they are out of step with modern thought, because today people, they're like little J.J. Abramses. They just want the mysteries.
Right.
When the answer comes, they're like, oh, I liked all the suspense better. Well, we need more suspense in religion is what I'm saying.
It's very difficult
ticking bombs under every pew.
It's very difficult to maintain credibility when you're offering definitive answers, because those answers now have to conform to what we know across a whole spectrum of science and data-driven experience. So if you know if as a religion you make a claim and it doesn't square with particle physics, and it doesn't square with molecular biology, and it doesn't square with whatever the latest Johns Hopkins set of experiments is,
behavioral.
It's very difficult for someone to say, I'm going to suspend disbelief. And a lot of these religions depend on faith, right? A suspension, a very clear-cut suspension of disbelief.
They're really in the language. They are acknowledging that, hey, we're providing you with certainty, but you are not going to feel certainty, because that's not just how spiritual matters work. You are still going to have to take a leap.
You're going to have to take a leap. And that was easier to do at a time when most people didn't have access to such a broad spectra of information.
You probably wouldn't have even had access to multiple religions. I mean, how religion, I think, is still kind of uppity about this, because they used to have, every religion had its own geographic monopoly. And as soon as one person in an odd hat said, here's the answer, nobody said, but what about, or let me double check against, or who agrees with you?
This guy with the other hat.
Right. Yeah. Like, as long as there's only one hat, theology is so easy.
And it was not that long ago, even in urban communities, that there was not a tremendous diversity of opinion or experience within a neighborhood or within even a town. But definitely the rise of literacy has made this more and more of an issue. It's religion spreads much more easily in a kind of in a format where your wisdom or your teachings are being received verbally, orally, in the context of a sermon, rather than sitting and studying a text.
Sure, studying gives you agency. Right. A listener hears what he or she is told.
And yet, as we sit and debunk religion, and as modern people sit and wrestle with religion, it still does. It's still enormously popular because it does fulfill a need. Right, there are complexities in we're no longer using, I don't think, religion to explain the rains or to explain like why there's sadness, but
definitely sadness more than rain.
Sadness more than rain, and our emotional lives remain unknowable to a certain extent. Our interactions with one another, our hopes and fears, our dreams.
Sense of purpose, yeah, exactly.
Those things resist data-driven analysis. They resist codification. They're
very individual.
They're extremely individual, even within a family.
So even if you know where lightning comes from.
Why it struck you.
Yeah, where's the lightning in your life?
Right, exactly. Is the big question. And so religion remains very popular. that, you know, that 1 billion people notwithstanding.
Is this an ad read?
And so.
So use promo code slash omnibus at your local church or mosque.
But as someone personally who was very interested in religion, but never found a doctrine that appealed even beyond the first blush of sort of critical appraisal, right? Like, is this what I'm looking for? It doesn't seem to be. Like, what I'm looking for is an explanation of the ineffable or the unknowable. Mm-hmm. And this seeks religions tend to seek to make the unknowable knowable. And as you said, that isn't really what I'm looking for, or what a lot of modern people are looking for.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, any answer is going to be an answer, and maybe you don't want an answer.
Right. And you've read William James, I'm assuming, that Varieties of Religious Experience.
I have never read Varieties of Religious Experience.
It's the one William James you haven't read.
Yeah, exactly. I'm almost done with it. Do not spoil the ending.
That was an attempt on his part to compare and contrast religions and try to find what is essential about them across the broad scope.
What did he find? What did he decide?
He had a lot. There were a lot of insights, and in particular, insights about the way religion, or the way a religious fervor takes a hold of someone that eventually is known as a prophet, but is initially known as a heretic. I mean, he took many, many instances of religious feeling and tried to examine it as a post-Enlightenment thinker, and compare religions to try to see where essential truths are. And this is the motivation behind comparative religion. It isn't the desire to compare religions is very seldom a desire to debunk them.
And it's not even a beauty pageant. You're not trying to, they're not competing.
No, it's
you want to find the root.
Right. A belief, a kind of post-scientific method belief, or post-philosophical Enlightenment belief, that if you compare them, perhaps you can winnow the truth away from what became the kind of the dressing, the liturgy of it, and find like what is it? Is there something fundamental there?
And you're an Enlightenment guy, but you like the fervor of it, which is maybe not the most fashionable thing about religion, the ecstatic experience.
Well, and the ecstatic experience is kind of at the heart of some very crucial aspects of the power of religion.
Sure, it would not exist if some people couldn't feel that and transmit the excitement to others.
And it's a very small group of people that end up, and this was some of what William James discovered, was that the people that actually feel have ecstatic experiences end up being totemic figures within their religion.
Because for every one of them, there's 100 people who have the hole in their life, but
right,
will never feel that.
10,000 or 100,000 people who want to hear, want to bask in the light of someone who has an ecstatic experience of God, but they're not having that experience personally, and also they don't want to get too close to that ecstatic person because they seem imbalanced. Like, most people that have an ecstatic experience of God are asked to leave the temple, and it's only when they wander in the desert.
Right, they're not usually the authorized ecstatic experience receiver.
Right,
ecstatic. There's a chain of command here, Jesus.
Ecstatic experiences are very threatening to power structures, to existing priests. And it's only later that those people's experiences are reformed and codified and turned into canon. But those are the experiences that are the most, they're the ones that shape and form religion and ultimately culture. Like, right now we're living in a world where a lot of religion is used to reinforce real conservatism, where all those initial prophets were radical, revolutionary people in their own time who were overturning, you know, the entire power structure of their era. And now the practice of those religions doesn't usually take that same form.
It could. You know, South American liberation theology, for example, in Catholicism. I mean, we may be just living in, I don't know if there's anything endemic about established religion, or if we just happen to be living in a time when there's an association between conservative thought and religion.
I think that religions get more conservative as they collect money and followers.
Well, absolutely. I mean, like any institution.
Right. It's always the evangelists that are that have the least to lose, I guess. And so can get maybe closer to the essence of whatever that ecstatic experience is, whatever that transformative human experience that sometimes we need to shake the tree a little bit.
Even in a secular society, people still want that totemic figure, but in the absence of a prophet, it's just going to be,
a bishop.
It's going to be Frank Ocean, or right. It's going to be Bernie, or it's going to be Trump, or, you know, people still want
a guide.
People still want a big head on the sign.
And there are also a lot of people, and I think you see it extensively now. People that are seeking an authentic and personal religious experience, unmitigated by intermediary, and that isn't. I think that the popularity of that now is somewhat due to this admixture of all religions, kind of in a bubbling pot, where it's like I'd like one, one from Christianity and one from column Buddhism and one from column New Age spirituality.
Your canonical like cafeteria,
right?
Acolyte.
All kind of born out of a desire to have some, to see some shining light themselves personally, rather than to have it, to have a set of rules kind of down from on high.
And of course, that's not incentivized in the major religious traditions, because it would be dangerous for too many followers to have their own unmediated experience.
How are you going to pass the collection
plate
around?
They're not going to come and put anything in the plate.
That's right.
I mean, and they won't agree on stuff for long, so it's a boundary maintenance and a conformity and homogeneity problem.
I think also in contemporary society, the access to and exploration, the discovery of psychoactive drugs by the mainstream. I mean, psychoactive drugs have been used to facilitate religious experiences since prehistoric times. You can find even in cave paintings evidence that psilocybin mushrooms were being used by Neanderthals.
The cave paintings get weirder next to the glowing moss that Og was licking.
That's right. Well, there's just there's like an ox, and there's a man with a spear, and then there's a guy with a hacky sack, and then
suddenly the ox has like rainbows and stars coming out of it. You can tell.
A drug that's used to facilitate like a religious experience,
and maybe even mimics the kind of response you see in the brain when people have ecstatic religious experience.
Well, that's a very interesting observation. Those drugs are called entheogens.
Entheogens,
mm-hmm.
I don't know this word.
And I think that there's a lot of awareness and understanding among people within the kind of drugs as religious facilitators community. And Timothy Leary talked about this. A lot of people that did LSD experimentation in the mid-20th century, it was very clear to them that the drug would give you a glimpse of what was accessible to you if you had a lasting and methodical spiritual awakening and transformation. The drug would give you a glimpse, but you couldn't sustain it.
The user has the sense that it's always still out of reach.
Well, if you're just getting there by way of the drug. So if you take LSD, you can see the curtains open and you see like the light, but then the curtains close.
You just take more LSD. This is not hard.
I think the revelation is that it's accessible to you only through a path, only through the hard work that, and this is a comparative religion experience too. Like, yes, if you're prepared to do the work, you can achieve, you can discover the light. But to simply have, when lightning strikes, it is not ever sufficient for the remainder of your life to just have had lightning strike. You then need to pursue a practice.
Everybody I know who has ever left a religious tradition, you know, does not rewrite history. They'll tell you about all the good experiences they had when they felt close to the divine or whatever. They just now interpret it differently because it was just a flash.
Right. Right. And that, and these entheogenic drugs, they are able to approximate or I'm sorry, not approximate. Maybe they are able to engender that lightning strike sensation. And you really do see, through the gauze, I guess. But then the realization that you need to then do the work
is a component of it. We need to make new drugs for Protestants that kind of, approximate just a really boring sermon. Like what drug do you take to give you that kind of nodding off in church?
That feeling of like, vibe. Is it, oh, it's only 30 more minutes. And then
counting the boards between the stained glass windows.
Then we go to the pancake restaurant. But religion also performs a lot of actual function, right? It isn't just hand waving. It's not just a money collecting.
There's
operation.
Personal improvement. There's community building. There's a service focus. Both on the individual and the community level.
And those are all the ways in which Mormonism operates in the world. But there
are you saying I have a Mormon blinkered view of this?
You're like, there's service, there's community, there's Jell-O pudding.
I would say personal improvement, community service are what any religious tradition should be offering. Or what is the point?
Well, there is a great need for religion, by desperate people. By people who have reached the end of their rope, right? Conversion often happens, or profound religious experience often happens in times of tremendous suffering, deprivation, when you're on your knees and casting up to heaven saying, why? Why?
I mean, everybody who has ever served a 2-year Latter-day Saint mission sees this in practice. You never get to talk to anybody who's normal and for whom things are going well because those people don't want to talk to a proselytizer.
Sure, they've got their own thing. They've got their own religion that they're barely adhering to.
Yeah, and their religion is, you know, that things are going okay for me. Like, right. that's what's first and foremost in their head, ahead of any spiritual concern. You only talk to people for whom things are going badly. You spend 2 years with crisis people.
Right.
And that's, I mean, you're absolutely right that is an appeal of religion, is it's a lifeline.
And you're offering them a salve, a balm for their suffering. But there are a lot of different kinds of suffering, right? There are people who are, you know, who lost a child and are wondering why. They have a trauma that that can never fully heal. But through religion, through God, through kind of an acceptance that there's a higher purpose, there's mercy in the world, that that maybe the child lives on somewhere in the ether. These things become a comfort. But there are other kinds of crisis, spiritual crisis, that are ongoing, that are not, they're not traumatic events that need an explanation. They aren't a kind of a vague sense of purposelessness, but they are actual their actual like living trauma in a person. And by those, I mean, people that have, that have real psychological problems. If you were someone with schizophrenia before the advent of psychiatry, before there was an explanation of it, when it was seen as a spiritual malady, it wasn't just that your mom and dad wanted you to find religion. I imagine the hope that God could relieve you of this suffering drove people toward the church.
It's quite literal in Christianity. People people have devils in them
right.
when they exhibit those kind of behaviors, and those can be literally cast out by God.
And before the advent of psychology or any kind of like a attempt to analyze these things outside of a religious context, almost any personality or experiential problem that was causing you suffering, you sought relief from that in not just I think a lot of people seek relief just in the methodology of a church. Like if I just go, if I say the right things, if I follow these sort of,
it's a structure. My life seems chaotic, but what if I just repeat these almost could be arbitrary steps?
Right.
Like, well, can I get through the day thanks to prayer and so forth?
But other people are hoping, or there are quite a few people, I think, in extreme situations that are hoping for a truly transformative experience, a lightning strike, something that will change their spiritual DNA and truly relieve them of what they feel is suffering. Right? If you were someone with pedophilia, who recognized that it was a crime in practice, but could not.
Inseparable part of myself and life.
Right. You would bow before God and say, please just relieve me of this suffering. Why is it here? Why was it put in me, and mm-hmm. how can I exorcise it? What do I have to do? Cause it's not as simple as just give me a practice, to keep me from sinning. You really are suffering from the spiritual malady.
And I assume in general, religion does not have a great track record at some of these.
Well, at least pedophilia, it doesn't.
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say.
Right.
If anything, it may be exacerbating it.
And this speaks to how unusual it is to actually have a transformative religious experience, to actually be struck by lightning. I think it's exceedingly rare that it really happened. We see a lot of people who exhibit signs or perform like a profound transformation. It's part of some religious services, right?
What if it's not a malady? What if it's a moral awakening? Do you believe in an Ebenezer Scrooge like? Moment of wait, I don't have to be like this. What if I were a generous person?
I do, and those are all on continuum, of course. Right. But also, like every kind of awakening like that, it then requires that you put the rubber to the road. There is no lightning strike where you are instantly transformed and then find virtuous action to be effortless. You can be transformed in a moment, but virtuous action is always going to be a difficult practice, not just for people.
It sure is for me.
Yes, I know. I mean, I see you every day struggle. You're like, two Diet Dr. Peppers? No.
It's more like, no, don't say something mean online. Don't say something snarky online. Oh, I'll just do just this once.
Be gone, devil.
I cast Twitter out of my operating system.
In my experience as someone who in his young life walked many paths and was eager to listen to anyone who kind of spoke what they considered a truth, right? I spent a lot of time sitting cross-legged in punk rock squat houses listening to guys explain to me how the world worked.
They were delighted to have an audience.
They loved it. And I would listen to anybody. You know, if you felt like you had a story to tell, I was there because I did believe that that there was wisdom to be gleaned from listening to everyone. And I spent a lot of time sitting in airports listening to Hare Krishnas explain what their story was. And, you know, the guy that was handing out Chick Tracks, I would stop and spend an hour listening to them explain.
To me, this is a story about how much free time you had.
I had a lot of free time. I had a lot of free time and a lot of, I mean, it wasn't just like vacant curiosity. I also felt like,
is it because you thought this might have something to teach me, or because this is a person, this is a human being? You like people. You just want to get to the bottom of that person.
I definitely I definitely enjoy getting to the bottom of people. But no, I believed that there were governing principles to the world. And I believed, as someone who had a somewhat agnostic feeling about religion, that I could not be agnostic about the music of the spheres, right?
Sure, it's a big deal if a higher power exists.
To say
you can't just say this is unknowable, I'm just going to play Mario Kart.
Yeah, to look up at the night sky and say I can say anything conclusive about it at all. In particular, when you think about the difficulty that we have with unified theories of any kind, with squaring, squaring string theory with
sure
Einsteinian physics. I mean,
just why does any of it exist? Why is there something instead of nothing? Why do I have consciousness that I perceive as an individual?
Right. Are we alone, et cetera? And so all of these questions, they're intriguing, I think, to any thinking person. And when you combine them with the inscrutability of emotion and the fact that that your emotion is real and is, at least within its self, within its own language, consistent, even those of us who, to someone outside, seem to be acting irrationally, within our emotional lives, it feels rational. It feels like we are internally consistent and acting according to what we perceive to be true. So you combine all that together, and if you can't square, like string theory with particle physics,
which I can't,
you need to also be able to square that with country Western music. Otherwise, it's not right. A unified theory, right?
I mean, you're exactly right. The kind of emotions you have listening to music seem like a very pure way to access these kind of questions, even though the rational link is hard to see. But you want to have an answer that meets it all.
That meets it all. Or at least puts you in the middle somewhere. Now, in my experience, and we've talked about this a lot, on the show, and I've talked about it a lot in various places. I got very into drinking and drugs at a pretty young age. I mean, not the youngest age, but I got drunk for the first time when I was 9. That I didn't continue to get drunk from 9 on.
I wasn't allowed to have chocolate cake until I was 10. So,
but by the time
it angers up the blood.
By the time I was 15, I was a regular drinker and a heavy drinker from early times. Growing up in Alaska, there's a lot of hard drinking, but there is hard drinking all around the world. And I found that it suited me. My father was an alcoholic. My older brother was. My grandfather was.
Does that, are you saying it on some genetic level you have a predisposition to it, or just that having seen it modeled, you knew how to be that kind of a man?
Well, I didn't see it modeled because my father stopped drinking before I was born.
Huh.
And my brother didn't live with us, and my grandfather was dead. So in trying to diagnose alcoholism and trying to ascertain what it is, there are a lot of writing on it. There's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of science.
A lot of Charles Bukowski books.
And there are a lot of strong opinions about whether or not it is an inherited disease, whether or not it is a spiritual malady, whether or not there are plenty of people who will tell you it's just a lack of willpower.
Well, I was going to ask, do you consider it like one of these chronic crises, one of these chronic maladies that cries out for meaning that you were talking about?
Well,
is that how it feels at some point?
It is. When you are a heavy drinker and then find yourself unable to, for lack of a better term, control your drinking, unable to be a normal person
anymore.
Right,
it really, it's not just the drinking, it informs everything in your life.
It throws a lot of those questions into bold relief because you, no one starts out, or rather, few people start out with the single-minded intention to destroy their lives. It's a pretty slow form, a slow and ugly and expensive form of destroying your life when you could just drive your car off the road.
It's very inefficient.
Right.
And a lot of, causes a lot more collateral damage.
And typically people that are that drink heavily also have, I mean, they have active minds. It's
they're quieting inner voices in many cases.
Yeah, and there's they tend to, in fact, be a fairly curious class of people, creative people. They are engaged.
What do you think the mechanism is there? Are they trying to experience new states of mind? Are they?
If you sit with any group of alcoholics or people who know alcoholics, you'll find 1,000 different explanations. Yeah, and within my own family, alcoholism is used as, I mean, with my uncle and cousins, almost anything can be explained simply by one person in the room going, well, alcohol. And then everybody nods sagely. That is used to explain the movement of the planets in my family. I don't believe that the planets move because of alcohol.
Certainly not from drinking in your family. No. Because the planets must have been moving before the first coal mining Roderick accidentally left his,
that's right,
his apple juice in the sun too long.
Presumably they were, although we cannot know for sure. But there's a moral component to drinking, alcohol and drug abuse.
What would you say are the moral principles that are being violated or tested?
Well, it isn't so much that they're being violated or tested, but that the drug use and abuse affect one at a moral level. It is a disease of the spirit, if anything. It's very difficult to point to the human body and find where the disease of alcoholism is located. You can't direct no one particular organ is creating some antibodies to fight alcohol, right? It's not a disease like leukemia.
Right.
It's a disease of the spirit somehow.
It's so holistic that it affects everything about you, and you experience it more on an emotional and moral level.
Yeah. Well, when you see someone affected by alcoholism, what you're seeing is not someone who is incapacitated by the decay of their cells.
Right. It's not their liver.
No, it's their personality. It's their spirit. It's their self that is that's suffering from malady.
And is it all the same story? Or does it feel like it's very individual based on the person? Or does everyone essentially turn into the same new alcoholic person?
Well, that is a super good question. And that kind of brings us to the topic of our show.
Finally.
Yes, that's right. And I have no, it's, but we're about an hour and a half into the show.
I don't remember what the topic was. I don't remember a time when I have not been doing this intro.
As I said at the beginning of the show, we've talked about a lot of sort of American Christian sects that arose in the 19th and early 20th century to
a lot of them little communes and communities. We think that's fun.
We do, and it in some ways it seems to reflect a kind of a Native Americanism, a desire to have a new religion that takes into consideration all this new information that we have about the world.
Disruption. We've disrupted government with the American experiment. Next up, the Church of England.
And yeah, that's right. Now we're going to form an Oneida cult, and we're going to make silverware up here.
We're gonna disrupt Methodism.
And as a part of that American tradition, into the 20th century, you know, and it's also part of a Protestant tradition where an American Baptist tradition where the idea of no intermediary between you and God
is not a shadowy organization.
Yeah, it's a profound power, I think, of these evangelical religions or of protest religions.
It's more future-proofed than just imagine there's a big government-like apparatus that moderates your relationship to God and just kind of trust that everything will go okay.
And that's I think what you do in town square religion, right? You don't want direct contact with God if all you're trying to do is sell hardware on Main Street. Mm-hmm. But if you're out on the frontier, if you're experiencing an unvarnished, unmitigated life, if you're out there, you know, nose in the wind.
Well, think of the sense of possibility that comes with just being able to, nothing exists till you build it.
Right. In America, in the early part of the 20th century, a man by the name of Frank Bachman was a Lutheran, ordained Lutheran minister, and was in the course of kind of, a very active, curious early life, was trying to find a parish where he could be the valued spiritual leader. He wanted to be in a big congregation. He didn't want to be sidelined out in some parish church. He was kind of a young hot rod, and in the course of his sort of pursuing his own career, he developed a normal amount of sort of resentments against people that stood in his way. And
where are we? American Midwest?
Yeah, he's a Pennsylvanian, as so much of Omnibus is just about Pennsylvania.
We are the official podcast of the state of Pennsylvania. We're on the license plate.
You know, and he's part of that, just like that Allentown, Pennsylvania, too. Just that sort of good old American Pennsylvania. And he was ordained right at the beginning of the 20th century, early 1900s. And in sort of exploring his faith and his young life as a minister, you know, he had the natural struggle of any sort of curious young person who felt thwarted on all sides by church hierarchies or by opportunities.
It's got to be very fraught to combine your faith with things like career, you know?
Right. I mean, that's you say that really well. And I think that's a more profound statement than it maybe seems at first blush. Like, to be a professional spiritual leader.
I mean, just imagine all the headaches that go with your job and hobby and marriage. And yeah. And now imagine just trying to, you know, keep your religious faith and fervor pure in the face of that. Good luck.
Right. And acting as an intermediary between
for others' God, religious experience.
Right. And this guy who's like, whose wife won't let him watch football on Sundays. But what happened to Reverend Bachman was that he underwent a spiritual, he had a lightning strikes moment. He was feeling depressed and anxious and disconnected from the church, and sort of wandering in the desert, and went to a religious seminar, and went to a religious seminar called the Keswick Convention, which happened in England, and in the course of sort of just one of these experiences, sitting in a church, and the light streamed in from through a stained glass window, and he felt that the resentments and the sort of dark feelings that he was carrying were lifted from him, and lifted by virtue of an understanding, a very simple understanding, that what we were doing, what he was doing as a religious person was doing a lot of talking, a lot of ego-based projection, and not very much listening, not very much communing with the Spirit, not very much just sort of patient surrender to what he imagined to be sort of, I mean, if it is an omniscient and all-powerful God, really what you should do is get out of the way, figure out what God has in mind for you, and sort of allow yourself to be a vessel for God's commands.
It's interesting that his moment of connection is actually an idea. It's an epiphany. I mean, it's, you know, many people, I myself have felt kind of the inexplicable lightening of a burden that I feel comes from outside myself. But, you know, the connection with an actual idea, I need to do something different. That's very powerful.
It was, and he reduced it to a very simple sort of mantra, which was he understood his revelation to be that there are four absolutes necessary to live in a kind of in a state of spiritual evolution or spiritual completeness.
I like four.
And the four absolutes.
It's small enough that you can remember them, but it's big enough that it, you know, it seems like it covers the problem.
Sure, there's a little bit of wiggle room in there where you can fit almost any problem.
I mean, Buddha had four as well. I think it's a good number. What are the four?
The four are absolute honesty. These are four practices that you need to walk through life according to these four principles. Absolute honesty, absolute purity. These are open to interpretation.
Sure.
Absolute unselfishness and absolute love.
Good luck.
There they are. And if you can bring to bear these four absolutes, it can relieve you of spiritual malady. So he didn't, his revelation wasn't just that these four absolutes were new principles, but in fact, they had helped him understand that his resentments, that his ego were things that inhibited his own connection to God, his own path through path in the world. So these were personally transformative first. And so in the course of describing this to others and sort of gathering young people together to say like, well, in order to practice this absolute honesty, we need to sit in a circle and reveal our shames and our failings, the lies we tell, like as we reveal this stuff about ourselves, we can be, we're free from it.
So he also developed some kind of program to help others with the structure of it?
It evolved into a program because as he explained it to other people, they wanted to, I mean, in order to have, in order to practice absolute honesty, you need someone to listen to you. Mm-hmm. No one wants a person newly charged with the task of being absolutely honest to like come home and say, honey, I have some things I need to,
right.
or I have some things I'm really excited to tell you.
People already have kids for that.
Yeah. So, so what formed was a group called the Oxford Group, and it happened at Oxford. The Oxford Group became a kind of Christian movement, not a revival movement, but a new Christian movement, which sought to really simplify the liturgy to this, to these basic four principles, and to go out into the world and make a sort of transformative, bring this transformative experience to the world. The Oxford Group was amazingly successful in the early part of the 20th century, and was
people set up their own little programs in their own places.
They did, and Frank Bachman went around the world as an emissary, and he was welcomed and embraced by most Christian religious authorities that he met, because there's nothing in these principles that really undermines a normal, you know, whatever the church is,
yeah,
that he comes into to express his revelation. He's not saying tear down these walls.
Yeah, he's not challenging any power structure. He's just putting some chairs in a circle. This is a more home-based way to put church principles into practice, right?
Right. And the idea being that this was work that could help the people who were finding their connection to the religion incomplete. The people that were maybe continuing to suffer, the people that were maybe outwardly prosperous, outwardly successful, but felt inside that they were unhappy, spiritually.
Like all successful people.
I right. spiritually desperate. So his Oxford Group now has become a kind of Christian, kind of a global Christian enterprise. Non-denominational Christian enterprise. Well, refocusing our attention to the United States, alcoholism at this point is
the national pastime.
It really was, and I think before prohibition, there was a period of several decades where a recognition that drinking was that hard drinking was a spiritual malady started to become more of an awareness.
A lot of the temperance movement was led by kind of religious fundamentalist types, right?
Right. And prior to that, you know, drunkenness, well, the life expectancy was only 40 years old. Who cared? How, you know, you died of drunkenness or cholera or, you know, arrows.
Every town needs a town drunk.
Right. But as and my speculation is with industrialization and as people lived longer and as people need, as people were required to do more specialized work.
Quality of life declining, maybe?
There was now people that were suffering from alcoholism that were habitual drinkers stood in bolder contrast to what a like a well-functioning, prosperous person that there was, they stood in bold relief. And so it was, it became a cause celeb that alcohol was a life destroyer, right? Destroying a happy home.
It's the same way we thought about street drugs in the '80s.
That brings us to the titular focus of this episode,
which we like to do about an hour in, is to get back to the subject briefly.
about an hour in. A man colloquially known. Did I say that correctly?
You said that like you still drink.
Colloquially known.
You're a hilarious town drunk.
By the name of Bill W. And Bill W. is known by his last initial only, because he founded a group called Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous, the second word of that is alcoholic.
The second word. They take the anonymity seriously enough that even though he is a celebrity and a founder of a major self-help religious movement, quasi-religious movement, his last name is not used.
Was redacted for many years because anonymity was a central precept to the organization, because at the time there was tremendous sort of social approbation.
Probably not too different now. Shame is what keeps people from seeking help sometimes, right?
Yes, except now, I mean, being an alcoholic and a drug abuser is it's understood to be a spiritual malady. There's an awful lot of drama around it, and people exploit it for glamour.
But you're right that it's largely treated as should be treated as an illness and not as a moral failing.
Well, and that, even that is still sort of depends on who you ask. But Bill W. was a man who suffered from alcoholism. He was a Vermonter who had served in World War I. He was a businessman, sort of varying success.
Is there a connection between his veteran status and his drinking?
I think a lot of veterans of World War I, including my own grandfather, that was a period where heavy drinking was a way of kind of resolving,
not remembering,
or managing your feelings. But Bill W. Was pretty clear that he had started drinking before the war and enjoyed alcohol from the very beginning.
He's a fan,
and in the course of his heavy drinking, his wife was a woman by the name of Lois W. Let's call her. And Lois recognized that her husband had a drinking problem, and they sought a lot of different remedies for it. And
so there was a sector for this now, like there this was ways to help you quit drinking.
There were a lot of them. There was there were a lot of different sort of alchemical solutions. There was something called
patent medicines.
Yeah, the Belladonna cure, which was a kind of aversion therapy. Yeah. It was, you know, you give an alcoholic,
throw up every time you drink.
That's right, and then they throw up, and you know, the idea being that if you vomit,
it's true that I don't eat cup of noodle anymore because I vomited once.
What? You wouldn't have a cup of noodle?
I used to love cup of noodle, and now it's your body's very good at remembering, hey, this is the thing that made us, these are the berries that made us sick once.
The problem with aversion therapies and alcohol is that
alcohol already makes you throw up.
It does. And also, like, alcohol, the appeal of it, or the pull of it rather, is so powerful that you will continue drinking and destroy your family, lose your business, lose your house, your wife divorces you, your kids don't speak to you.
A sore stomach is the least of your worries.
That's right. And the idea that you could just vomit unpleasantly a few times and that would cure you of this thing that, you know, that people will drink themselves to death routinely, is kind of a little bit of an underestimation of the power of the drug. Anyway, Bill W. In seeking some kind of relief from his alcoholic struggles, he was a Vermonter, and this was at a in an era where people would summer in Vermont. It was a sort of a in his social class,
wealthy people would take the train to Vermont and enjoy the mountains or whatever. Right.
He was associated, or he was friends with, let's say, a man by the name of Roland Hazard, who was a sort of Brahmin East Coast scion of wealthy old money.
And I can tell he's not an alcoholic because you said his last name.
Well, Roland Hazard was never a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, he was an alcoholic, and he was rich enough that he was at one point he was analyzed by Carl Jung. He traveled to Europe in order to have Jung, you know, evaluate him and advise him. And Jung recognized that alcoholism was not a mental problem, but that it was a spiritual one. And he believed that the only cure for it, you couldn't think your way out of it. The only cure for it was that you have a transformative experience. And so Roland Hazard, as a result of this consultation with Jung, came back, and the Oxford group was very fashionable at the time. It was in all the newspapers. It was the latest fad.
Even on this side of the Atlantic?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. It became very popular in America.
I guess the guy's an American, even if he founded it over there.
And
right?
Frank Bachman, you know, brought it back here and saw the power it could have in the United States. And Bachman was not a typical evangelist in the sense he wasn't profiting from it. He wasn't trying to. There's you don't get any sense that he was that this was a cynical, like this isn't a Scientology, right?
He wasn't selling books and T-shirts.
No, this was a thing that he truly believed was transformative. And so as Bill sought refuge from his drinking, he became somewhat affiliated with the Oxford group, and or you know, attended Oxford group meetings. Roland Hazard used the principles of the Oxford group to stop drinking himself.
Principles being, you're talking about the absolute honesty and so forth, or just the physical practice of a bunch of people sitting in chairs and
stories and trying to be ruthlessly honest, trying to be unselfish, trying to, you know, to practice these principles as they say in AA. Roland did not actually manage to stay sober through Oxford group practice alone. Roland Hazard never actually joined AA. And Bill, although he got sober, was having a rough ride, a bumpy path. And at one point, he was working as a traveling salesman. He was in Akron, Ohio.
It's got to be the worst job for an alcoholic.
Really bad.
Alone in a new city, where would you go to? You can sit in your hotel room and drink, or go to a place where there's people, which is a tavern, and drink.
And what do you do if you go have a sales meeting and you fail to make
the sale? There's also the stress of the job.
Then you go back to your hotel and really want to drink. And that's what happened with Bill. And in that moment of, in his moment of desperation, he actually called some Oxford group people there in Akron, Ohio, and said, "Hey, can you connect me with anybody, any Oxford members hanging out here?"
He had the presence of mind to reach out.
That's
impressive if he's feeling like, you know, desperate.
And it feels very much in the spirit of the Oxford group that you would, in that moment, try to find somebody to be unsparingly honest.
They're your first resource, yeah.
And the person that he was put in touch with by the local secretary of the group or whatever was a man also known within the program as Dr. Bob. So we can reveal we can break their anonymity here, because the Omnibus is not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. The Omnibus is a science show.
If it's an Omnibus, if it was an AA meeting, we would have cookies after.
Right. Bill W.'s last name is Wilson, Bill Wilson. Dr. Bob was also from Vermont, although their meeting, it was coincidental. Their meeting was in Ohio.
Is it a coincidence? Maybe there's something about that hardy Vermont hickory spirit that leads you to
UFOs.
Or it could be UFOs.
Dr. Bob was a man named Bob Smith.
It Robert Smith of The Cure?
It's Robert Smith, yes.
Is it Robert Smith of The Cure, though?
It is, yes.
Wow, that's fascinating. Yeah.
Love cats. Baby, love cats.
Don't love drink.
He was a surgeon who was a desperate alcoholic and would like have to have a couple of beers before going into surgery.
Yeesh.
And he also had been suffering for a long time. And constantly relapsing, had found the Oxford Group, was trying to use Oxford Group technologies to recover from alcohol, and, you know, with varying degrees of success. And Bill called him in the middle of the night and said, let's get together, you know, and maybe we can, you know, just keep each other sober tonight. And in the experience of the two of them being together there meeting in Akron, and both with this Oxford Group grounding mm-hmm. in a kind of in the idea that you could have this firsthand personal sort of transformation that you could prolong by practicing these very simple sort of four precepts, they discovered that their desire to drink had been relieved, that they truly felt that some burden had been lifted from their shoulders, as you've described.
Transformation.
Yeah, that's right. And they realized that what they'd done was they had discovered a further innovation, which was that it was not simply enough to practice absolute honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, but that you needed then to take that message to someone else that was still suffering.
And that helps relieve your own suffering and maladies and worst urges as well.
That's right. And if you look at the history of organized religion, there is always a component of spreading the message, right? The Jews don't typically recruit, but most religions do want to try and go out and pacify the barbarians and bring the message to them.
But it's not usually therapeutic for, you don't get the sense that, you know, Jesus was having a bad day.
Well, that's the curious thing that from a comparative religion standpoint, how much of the, it's never, you're absolutely right. It's never really, explicitly
it's
said.
It's not part of the story, right? That right, like Muhammad was, you know.
I mean, you have a Christian obligation to spread the news,
mm-hmm.
but it's not. Then also said, it's not also written that spreading the news is how you retain your own faith. Although I imagine that is a component of, I mean, you have been a missionary.
Yeah, I'm sure that's why, I mean, it's a big reason for the institutional insistence on like a 2-year mission service for young Latter-day Saint kids is because, I mean, it's the most vulnerable time in a young person's life. Specifically, think of all the trouble a young man can get up to between 19 and 21.
Sure, you could be rumspringing all over the place.
What if you were doing the opposite of rumspringing, like a rumfalla?
Right.
Where all you're doing is kind of reinforcing your own beliefs by expressing them to others. But it's very explicit in AA, right? And it's not just because this strengthens your commitment to AA. It's because
it actually is the process by which you...
That is the healing.
You heal, yeah. Right. That you cannot...
It's not a means to an end.
Right. You cannot be in AA and not bring that message to other... Or try to help people who are suffering.
Have you found that personally to be the most helpful thing for you? Does that seem to be the agent of change for you?
It's absolutely different from proselytizing or evangelizing, uh-huh. Right? You do not... In AA, you do not go to a bar and stand there handing out pamphlets. Right.
Although maybe you should. That would be hilarious.
It would be funny for 1 second. No, what you do is you make yourself available to people who are suffering. And Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the principles is that they don't recruit. They operate according to a principle of attraction rather than promotion.
It goes the other way. Right. Like you are a resource for people to reach out to you when they need it.
If someone needs AA, they are already suffering enough to find it, right? You don't If you're out like canvassing schools saying, "Hey kids, come join AA," that's not how it works, right? You have to already be in desperate straits to need this kind of transformation.
And I know you have been a resource to many, and are probably still to many people who do need that. And what does it do to you?
I mean, the selflessness of it, if you think about back to the Oxford group the principles of the Oxford group were transformed by Bill W. and Dr. Bob into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which are, which break out those ideas into steps that you can follow. It basically,
but they seem still clearly based on things like honesty and unselfishness and so forth.
They are. And it became an institution.
Admitting you have a problem is honesty, and
but that's the thing. All of them, honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love, are all interactive values. You cannot really get very far being unselfish
You can't go into the desert and be an unselfish hermit.
Yeah. Right. Or nor can you really love. I mean, all of those are interactive. All of them need to, in order to activate them, you need to, they're values of giving. Mm-hmm. And if what you have is the experience of having been tormented and then having been relieved of that torment by someone else's help, but you know, by an intervention of someone else's goodwill, selfless goodwill. No one in Alcoholics Anonymous makes any money. You don't get anything out of it, right? That's not a Ponzi scheme. There's the
and it's beautiful that it's like in its what? It's in its how old is AA? 70 years old.
So Dr. Bob and Bill W. had this first encounter in 1935.
Oh, okay.
The Oxford group actually underwent a transformation right after this too. Frank Bachman watched as the world rearmed in advance of World War II. And he went to Germany and he tried to get an audience with Hitler. He tried to convert the Nazis to Oxford group thinking, so much so
that it becomes like a pacifist organization.
Yeah. So much so that the Nazis identified him as an enemy of National Socialism and, you know, like he had him followed and, you know, whatever, Himmler and Bohm, and they spoke out against him. He changed the name of the Oxford group to the Moral Rearmament Society. Rearmament Society. So as we were rearming in guns, he believed that we needed to morally rearm. And that really resonated with the world at the time. The organization ended up changing its name to the MRA, which is an unfortunate acronym. And the Moral Rearmament Society flourished during the war and after. Bachman played a major role in like the anti-colonial era. He was credited by...
Oh, like he's an influence on Gandhi?
Yeah, he met with Gandhi many times, and they had a great admiration for one another. But also, he played an instrumental role in the liberation of Morocco, or the Morocco and Tunisia's like liberation.
Independence.
But also, he acted as a facilitator of German and French... friendship in the post-war world.
It's funny that he becomes a moral authority without ever actually having any kind of portfolio or position.
He built this way of thinking. Bill W. and Dr. Bob wrote down their version of the Oxford group thinking in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and started having basically what were Oxford group meetings, but exclusive to people that were struggling with alcohol. And they adopted the idea of the principle of anonymity within the group, so much so that when Alcoholics Anonymous took off and became like a socially transformative group, mm-hmm. Yale offered Bill an honorary degree, and he turned it down because he didn't want to be named, or didn't want it to be about himself. He didn't as a gesture of egolessness. He turned down the degree, and Time magazine wanted to put him on the cover, and he refused that honor too.
That's not very 20th century.
And he was only outed as Bill Wilson at his death when journalists wrote his obituary. And it was the first time that, you know, that anyone kind of outside of the scuttlebutt of the of Alcoholics Anonymous knew his name.
People must have known. So it's nice that they respected the culture of the group. I've understood that it's actually a difficulty in trying to study the efficacy of these kind of programs is that the strict anonymity of the AA structure means that no clinical trial is really ever possible.
And even in discussing it on the program, like I think I've been clear that I'm not advocating for it, or I'm not acting as a spokesperson for it. I don't really even claim membership in it. Only that I have experience with it, and I'm trying to describe its foundation.
But a positive experience for you. I mean, if you're asked point blank.
Oh, my sense of it is that, you know, alcoholism is. And drug addiction are incredibly complicated and pernicious problems in a human being. And if there were a cure that worked universally, we would all know mm-hmm. what it was. There is no one cure, and there is no surefire cure. But in my experience, the principles and the structure of 12-step recovery movements, if you go into those rooms with a sincere desire to make a change, or a sincere desire just to be open to the prospect of change, your prognosis is good. It's just that the hardest step is the one across that threshold. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there's difficulty ahead in the future in a more secular society of, you know, just a group of people being willing to recognize a malady as having a spiritual component. I mean, that's a barrier to entry to some people in AA today.
It's
higher power. Come on.
It's a major barrier of entry. I think most people that, anyone who is looking for a reason not to go to AA, you can, those are easy to find. And a major one
I have is, a pretty good one.
Yeah. You're not alcoholic. You never had alcohol.
Right. Maybe I am an alcoholic. I don't know. I'm a dry alcoholic.
We'll never know.
If I ever try a sip.
But a lot of people do not want that religious component because it does feel like the tint of a cult or of a group. We're used to religious groups sort of trying to get a toehold in your life, and then gradually they introduce more and more like strange performance, and pretty soon you are wearing matching Nike tennis shoes and castrating yourself and dying in a bunk bed. But
those are the three principles.
But I think anyone living, even someone atheistic, has to acknowledge that there are aspects to our inner life that are very difficult to comprehend, if nothing else.
And I assume that's what AA does, right? They define higher power broadly enough that you just mean anything bigger than yourself,
anything other than yourself, huh. Right? Anything where you can make a special plea and say that these are that my own ego, my own suffering isn't any more like apprehendable or solvable by me alone. And
it's pretty genius because the actual desperation of your position is what leads to the solution. Like you're convincing yourself every day that there's nothing you can do because of just how badly things are going.
Right. And that is a tremendously powerful admission, and from it, all things can follow, right? But it's the most difficult thing for someone suffering from a spiritual malady to do is acknowledge that they no longer have the power to solve that problem for themselves. And you know, from that small revelation, a tremendous good has been accomplished, I think, by the by the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous are still alive, right? There, nothing is, although those, we've decided, I think, that those books are canon, like, because it is not hierarchical, and because this problem is so individual in every person, it means that that whatever the practice is, it's never static. It's still alive. Every single day, someone newly admits that they, that like humility is the first step. And,
it is impressive that 85 years in or whatever, it's still just this grassroots thing and has not developed any kind of apparatus with its own organizational troubles and scandals. It's totally resistant to that.
Yeah. Every meeting is a completely autonomous organism. And from one week to the next,
I wonder if it's a model to solve other problems.
Well, it is employed that way, right? And that's the danger, because as soon as you take it out and start employing it as a methodology, it becomes ripe to be misunderstood, mm-hmm. right? As soon as you say like, oh, this is how all town meetings should be conducted, and I'm going to take that out and call it Ken Jenningsism, you know, like you see a 12-step, the 12-step process being bastardized
in multi-level marketing and
everywhere. And in fact, any system in which the courts sentence people to 12-step programs, you have missed the point.
Right.
You don't get sentenced to a period, a 12-step meeting.
The whole miracle of it is the voluntary first step.
And so you go to meetings all the time and you see people who are sitting there just like sullenly waiting through the meeting in order to get their little slip of paper from the court signed by the person chairing the meeting, and nobody wants. I mean, it's not like the people in the meeting don't want them there. It's like, yeah, if this works, if it helps you, that's great.
I know you can't talk about meetings, but on some level, does it ruin the vibe? It must ruin the vibe.
Depends on how small the meeting is. Yeah. But the thing is, there's always somebody that comes into the meeting and is like, I don't think I belong here. It's part of getting there, right? I used to get drunk and go to AA meetings.
Is it more fun?
Yeah.
And that concludes Bill W. Entry 122.NU0603. Certificate number 19544 in the omnibus. Now, social media is also a spiritual malady, but in our day, John and I had not yet 12-stepped our way out of it. We're still at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, and jointly at Omnibus Project on various social media platforms. We love the shenanigans of the Futurelings on Facebook. Occasionally, people will email us feedback at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and we incorporate that into our addenda episodes that we now offer as a monthly benefit for donors. If you would like to subscribe, you can do so at patreon.com/omnibusproject. We received physical mail at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington 98155. I recently received these delightful Chick Tracks. I put out a call.
Aww.
Speaking of evangelizing for these odd little comic books. And last time I checked the mail, a couple people had obliged.
Nice.
Feather sent me one that she got for the shoe store she worked at. Somebody returned a pair of damaged shoes with a Chick Tract in it, perhaps in hopes that that would make up for the damage on the shoes she was trying to get a refund for. I would be less likely to grant a refund if somebody sent me one of those, but that's just me. Jason sent me a nice stack of them, but he apologized that he doesn't have his favorites. He did not have the D&D one, the worst anti-Catholic one, and one he vaguely remembers where two truckers debate about Jesus being a sissy. It's kind of a bummer that he sent me a bunch of Chick Tracks and then told me about better ones that he's not going to send me. But we're delighted to receive physical artifacts, and those we put up on the Patreon as well.
Futurelings, we hope and pray that we did keep doing this show long enough to cover all of my thoughts on comparative religion. But if the worst comes soon, this recording may be the last show I did on comparative religion, which is which would be desperate. But if providence, in the form of whatever higher power works for you...
Here, this is me opening my first beer.
Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.